You're listening to KSCO Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. David Haidu returns to the show this week. He's the author of several books, including the brilliant history of the campaign against comic books in the 1950s, The 10-Cent Plague, and Positively 4th Street, a book about the intersection of the lives of Joan Baez, Richard Ferrigno, Bob Dylan, and Mimi Ferrigno. And now David Haidu has written my new favorite book, Love for Sale, Pop Music in America. David Haidu, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Oh, thanks for having me, Gary. I had such a good time with you last time. I'm very excited about talking again.
It's good to have you. I love your new book, Love for Sale, Pop Music in America, or as I like to call it, The Freewheeling David Haidu.
No, that's true. It is. It is a loopy, strange, kind of unpredictable book. So that's a pretty good description. I wish I had thought of that. I could have used that.
There could have been a picture of you and your wife walking down the snowy street.
Walking down Jones Street, which doesn't look all that different, by the way, than it did in that great picture of Susie Rotolo and Dylan. Yeah. Well, you know, thanks, because when I was writing the book, and I worked on it for some time, it probably took me longer than any of my other books, and Lush Life, my first book, took 11 years, but this is something I've been working on for some time. I felt that it was more of a gamble than anything I had done, and I know it's a strange book, and it's completely different from very different from most of what I've written in the past, and I didn't really know how it would go over, you know, if the concept, the notion for it, well, I'm not going to gussy it up by calling it a concept, but if the notion for it really was sound, or that, you know, the people would get it or appreciate it. And so far, so good.
You got a nice review in the New York Book Review. That was great. New York Times Book Review.
Yeah, that's always nice, and a lot of other reviews of all over the place. In fact, you're in Santa Cruz, right?
Yeah.
I got a review today in the L.A. Times Book Review, a long review. It's the second one by the L.A. Times Book Review. So the L.A. Times Book Reviews can't get enough of this book. So they actually did two long and appreciative reviews. So I'm very grateful.
I hope they didn't give away the ending. Oh, no, I guess that doesn't apply.
No. Although that would be a bigger problem with some of my earlier books, particularly Positively 4th Street.
Yeah. Yeah.
Should we talk about the design and the strangeness of the design?
Sure, go ahead.
The book is, as you know, because you've read it, peculiar hybrid of music history, and the history part of it I took seriously, and I had some ideas about what I thought would be a responsible history and sort of a corrective history. There's some things I wanted to do in a history of pop music that maybe we could come back to, and also criticism and analysis, because that's most of what I do as a writer, is criticism and, you know, analytical writing, and had a bunch of ideas that I wanted an excuse to put on my computer screen, and then the third part of it was personal rumination and reflection about the role that popular music in particular has had in my own life, and what it's meant to me. And I thought I would try to, instead of doing three books and do them, which probably make more sense, I thought I'd do all three of those books in one and entwine all three approaches in one book and sort of toggle back and forth between.
Shmush them together.
Yeah, and the reason I did is I just found it, the reason I thought it was important to bring in the personal was that over the years that I've thought about music, it strikes me that so much of not just our taste, but our values and our understanding of music, in all art, is informed by personal experience and the role that music had in our life, And it's over the years, I've grown increasingly convinced that it's impossible to wholly extricate like aesthetic values and meaning from experience. So I thought, well, I'm just going to dive in and try to deal with all of this together. If you can indulge me, can I give you an example that's on the top of my mind today?
Please.
Would you mind?
Yeah.
As we're speaking, I don't know if I should say this because I don't know when this will air, and I know it'll be archived, but we're talking on Martin Luther King's the holiday to celebrate Martin Luther King Day. And this morning, I was poking around on the web and looking at songs dedicated to Martin Luther King, specifically in honor of Martin Luther King. And I was thinking of Nina Simone's Why. I don't know if you know that tune. Beautiful tune.
Beautiful.
Yeah. And then it led me to find some references to Blackbird, the Beatles song written by Paul McCartney, which is based on Bach's Beret.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen McCartney in concert 12, 15 times. I've interviewed him twice at some length. And in concerts, he often talks about how he followed the civil rights movement from a distance in England and wanted to make a statement about the civil rights movement, but wanted to do it obliquely and poetically. And he chose as an image the image of a blackbird waiting for this moment to arise, and with a broken wing to represent the struggle of African Americans during the civil rights movement. And he's talked about this in concerts, and sometimes in concerts he has a slideshow of the images from the civil rights movement and Martin Luther King projected behind him during the performance of the song. Meanwhile, I have a bootleg recording of McCartney in 1968, shortly after he composed this song, and he's with Donovan, and the two of them are in the Apple Studios, and they're playing together and talking. And on this recording, I can send you a copy of it. He says, "I wrote a song about a blackbird, and I just read that someone is interpreting it as a song about the civil rights." That's not what I had in mind at all. I wrote a song about a blackbird, but that's nice. Now,
so he had a retroactive interpretation of the song.
Well, so what happened is it was a song about a blackbird that became about something else to other people. It meant something. It was received as something else and interpreted as something else. And then it actually became that thing. And it even became that thing for the composer. And I've found this over and over again. My wife sings a song called Secret Love. My wife is a jazz singer. She sings a song called Secret Love. And I had a conversation about Secret Love with someone, and I was talking about the fact that it became a gay anthem in the 1950s, when gay men and women were severely repressed minority, and they felt like their same-sex attraction had to be a deep secret because homosexuality was criminalized in most states and was pathologized in the medical literature. And somebody said to me, "Well, that's not at all what it's about. It wasn't written about that." Well, but there's a difference between what it was intended to be and what it became. And really, things become something unique to each individual. And that's, meaning sort of settles in a unique way in the heart of each person.
And another great example of that is Tie a Yellow Ribbon. You remember that?
Of course.
Yeah.
Who could forget that? Right. You hear that once and it's stuck in your brain.
In fact, now that I've just said it, it's playing in your head, right? But when that song first came out, Tony Orlando and Don, I believe, recorded. So that song was about a guy coming home from prison.
Right.
In the lyrics, "I'm coming home, I've done my time," right? But,
exactly.
But then it became a thing about heroes coming back from the war. I think it was after the Gulf War that everybody was tying yellow ribbons on their tree for their soldiers.
Right. And it's wrong to think that one of these meanings is right and one of these meanings is wrong. Well, I read in the book about the fact that my parents' favorite song was For the Good Times, the Kris Kristofferson song, which, you know, it's about a couple that broke up, you know, and they want to recall the good times now that it's over. And on my parents' anniversary, they would sit, they would listen to For the Good Times and hold hands and look, gaze at each other wistfully. And think, well, it's a song about it being all over. But it wasn't to them, you know. Well, they hooked on to the image of the good times, and, you know, and that was a powerful message to them, and an important message to them. And so that became what the song meant to them. So the book is partly informed by that kind of thinking, but it's not, you've read it, so you know, it's not completely subjective. It's not as if I'm saying, well, this means this to me. In fact, if you look at the percentages, I'm only in it probably my own experience figures only in maybe 5-10% of the book. But you know, the history of popular music and my thinking about popular music is sort of peppered here and there with my own thoughts, as I thought they would help clarify or amplify or augment or add to the ideas that I wanted to discuss about pop history. So I think that I'm not in there sort of randomly or arbitrarily. I think I'm there for a good reason.
It gives a good context.
Strange, but it's still a strange book.
it's a good book. We're talking with David Hadew, and his new book is called Love for Sale, Pop Music in America. I was talking with Los Angeles DJ Dave Hull, and he told me that back in 1965 he was on the air, and it was his anniversary, and he was supposed to play a song for his wife, and he just like forgot, and it was like he had like one record to go, and he grabbed the next record and he put it on, and it was You've Lost That Lovin' Feeling.
Oh my God.
That was a bad choice. But,
yeah, really bad.
So what about the term pop music? It's kind of an annoying term.
Yeah. It's an annoying term to me because it's useful only, I think, maybe as a sociological descriptor. Like, what does it tell us? It tells us that the music is popular. That means that a certain number of people it's appealed to a certain number of people, or a certain number of people demonstrated some interest in it some way or another by, you know, downloading it or streaming it or buying it or playing it or going to concerts where it's played or whatever. But it doesn't really tell you much about the character of the music, why it's popular to certain people at a certain time, how it makes you feel, what it makes you think. A lot of the measures of popularity that are most familiar and commonplace don't quite get us to the music that most endures. You know, something could be a smash hit, have high numbers, and make its way into those playlists that perpetually play, like You've Lost That Lovin' Feeling is now, interesting you should bring that up, is now the most played song on the radio. I've saw a statistic about that within in the last year. It's now, I think it's been played more than anything else. Yesterday has the most number of, the highest number of performances, like the number of different versions. But the song, as I understand, that's been played most is You've Lost That Lovin' Feeling. And that's partly because it's recognized as the song that's played most, so therefore it's played more. So your popularity is sort of self-perpetuating. But there are songs that just slightly below the top 10 or below the top 20 or below the top 40 that connect with people in deep ways, and their importance cannot be measured by their popularity. I mean, for me, I talk about the importance of, for me, in a Pistol to Dippy. Do you remember that Donovan song?
Absolutely, sure.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's sort of trippy and druggy, and there's a reference to taking the elevator in the Brain Hotel in it. It wasn't the number one song.
I didn't know what that lyric was for the longest time.
Well, it's very
elevator
hard to,
in the Brain Hotel.
Brain Hotel. It's very hard to parse those lyrics because one of Donovan's things is the weird accents and the syllables.
Yes.
He does.
Alizari and Crimson.
You're right. What are some of the others? And I can't, off the top of my head, remember the examples. They are sort of hard to
hard
to remember.
Epistle to Dippy.
Epistle to Dippy. Or in the same year, Let's Spend the Night Together, which was the B-side of Ruby Tuesday. Now, Ruby Tuesday was the bigger hit. That was the A-side, but Let's Spend the Night Together is the one that clicked to me because it evoked, when I was a young kid, I think 10 or 11 at the time, because it was so naughty and it was suggested the forbidden. I was raised as a Roman Catholic in an Italian-American family in New Jersey, and spend the night together, right? That's just that, without marriage, you know, without a priest, it just... It wasn't even played on the radio in most stations because it was scandalous. And when the Rolling Stones played it on the Ed Sullivan Show, they had to change the lyrics to "Let's Spend Some Time Together" because that was so scandalous. So naturally, that naughtiness is a source of endless appeal, bottomless appeal to young people, particularly adolescents and pre-adolescents. So that's the one that really stuck with me. But its success really can't be measured by the numbers. Now, another thing about popular music that's really critically important to remember that I try to drive home in the book, that is that even though we think of the word of pop music, we think of popular music as a relatively recent thing, maybe even a post-war phenomenon, it is not at all. And music, there were pop hits that were called pop hits and popular music that was referred to as popular music and hits that were referred to as hits on a scale that not only compares with the scale of hits today but surpasses it 100 years ago and further back in time. The late 19th century, there were hits that sold 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 million copies. This at a time when the population was about a third what it is now. So we have a population that's one-third the size of the U.S. population, and hits are selling 5 million, up to 5 million copies. They're bigger hits than anything we could conceive of today.
Oh, the Star Spangled Banner was a hit like that, right?
Well, yeah, but I'm talking about pop songs. I mean, popular songs that were written to be popular songs, written and called popular songs in their day. I found an article in one of the major New York papers, either the Herald Tribune or the New York Times, in the first decade of the 20th century that reported that the era of the big song hits has passed. It had already reported that the era of the big song had passed in the first decade because there were no longer hits that were selling in the millions and millions of copies. Now, these hits were in sheet music, and the reason that there was a perception that the era of hits had passed was that records were not yet selling in those numbers, and radio hadn't even really emerged yet in a significant way. But sheet music, pop songs in the form of sheet music, sold millions of copies, and people played them at home on the piano. And experience the music in a completely different way than we experience music today. But in a way, we're more deeply connected to it because they didn't just listen. They didn't listen to it passively and take it in, or consume it, or experience it. They were producing it. They were making it. You know, they had an active part in the making of the music at the piano at home or singing next to the pianist at home. So, you know, it cut to people in a deep, in a literally physical way, as people sang the songs. So one of the missions of my book was to sort of remind people or alert them to the fact that, you know, pop music is has much deeper roots in America than they may think. And it's taken many forms, not just a form of, we think now, oh, street pop music's not the same anymore because they're streaming. Well, wait a minute. There was pop music before there were records, you know. So it's taken many forms as a popular phenomenon for a long time.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSEO. Getting back to our conversation with music historian David Haydu, his latest book is called Love for Sale, Pop Music in America. We were talking about the term pop music, and there are some people who, for one reason or another, are turned off by the term popular. Once they know something's popular, then they don't want to have anything to do with it. I'm not going to go see Titanic.
Right.
Because everybody...
Well, that's me. I'm of both minds. I mean, I'm like a secret pop music fan because I'm a child of the 60s, so I'm programmed to want to be defiant and radical. So, you know, oh no, if that's popular, I can't like it. And that's really a way of, it's on the surface a way of rejecting hierarchical thinking, but it's really not that. It's really a way of subscribing to a hierarchical mode, but claiming the highest point in that hierarchy, saying, oh, I know better than the masses because I'm smarter or I'm cooler than the masses, therefore I'm on a level even above them. And it's arrogant, but it's to be expected in a culture that has always romanticized and glamorized, you know, outsiders and rebels and, you know, cowboys and, you know, outliers of all kinds. You know, the romantic ideal in the United States, particularly in popular culture, dating again back to the 19th century, has always been a free thinker or an outsider of one kind or another. So, you know, even though, you know, we're part of a mass culture and a commercial society, and we all follow charts of one sort or another, whether it's the box office or the ratings or the Billboard charts. You know, not that we all do, but a lot of people are interested in that. We reject popularity at the same time. I always did, because, not only because I'm a product of the 60s, but because I can't help associate the idea of popularity with a sphere to which I was not welcome when I was an adolescent. I mean, I wasn't a popular kid. I mean, popularity was something that, it was a privilege that all those good-looking boys and girls had who I envied and resented. You know, I wanted to be, I never could be in the popular crowd, so I've always thought of myself as superior somehow, which of course is a delusion and messed up, but one that I don't think is unique to my experience. I think a lot of people probably feel that way. And then, I could talk for, we could fill the rest of our time together with all the reasons why I think Tie a Yellow Ribbon is pandering, simplistic, you know, reductive, corny, you know, and I could lay out all the arguments on aesthetic grounds for why it's
not good,
not great art. Yeah. But when it comes on, you know, I have fun for 2.5 minutes.
Yeah, yes, love will keep us together, or, you know, right. Groovy kind of love. There's a lot of songs that are hooky and... Right. And therefore, we recognize them as not being good, but we still love them.
And so, you can make a sound argument that that's a measure of good. That is a measure of good.
If you like it, it's good.
It's not an easy thing. You know, Duke Ellington said there are two kinds of music: good music and bad music. And if you like it, it's good. Now, that's a pretty simplistic argument. But
yeah,
if you like it, there's probably a reason that it appeals to you. There's probably a reason that it connects to you. And I think it's simple-minded to reject something just because it's it's popular.
Just because it's popular, right. Because something is popular doesn't mean it's bad.
Right. I mean, I don't know where you stand on something like Call Me Maybe.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, I mean, it's the kind of song where the first time you heard it, it was funny and adorable, and then, you know, the 75th time you heard it, you said, well, I'm kind of tired of it now, and then the 3,000th time you heard it, you said, please turn that off.
Right. Well, that is a problem with popularities. Then you become overexposed to something, and there's very little work that could bear that kind of repetition.
Yeah,
I mean, even the songs that I think that I love the most, I don't want to hear constantly.
I was listening to Stairway to Heaven the other day, and I realized, oh, it's really good. I'd, like, forgotten that it was good because it is the FM version of You've Lost That Lovin' Feeling, and that it's played,
right.
played
you
more.
Really do need, you really do need some time away from it. Yeah. Gary, what's your favorite song?
Oh, I don't know. My favorite song of all time is Tie a Yellow Ribbon Around the Old Oak Tree Pump.
Really?
No.
No.
I don't know. I how could you say that? What's your favorite food? You know, I don't know. And there's so many great, great songs and so many great albums. And you know,
you have
also,
a favorite Beatles song? The one you enjoy most?
It's easier to tell the Beatles songs I don't like than the ones that I love. But, I love them. I do love them. And I guess I love Strawberry Fields, and I love At This Moment, and I love Her.
Mm-hmm.
Those are two that come to mind instantly. I love Here, There, and Everywhere, and I love Here Comes the Sun.
They all have something sort of miraculous. It's extraordinary quality that the Beatles have, and yet I think because they touch so many people, I think we'd find that each one of those songs has a, I mean, when you just, a very specific memory popped into my head for every one of those songs that you mentioned, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, a very, very specific memory. And I love Her. My wife and I played at a wedding on the first day of legal gay marriage in Provincetown, and I had to learn it to play for her. She's a singer, and I'm an amateur guitarist and pianist, so I had to learn it for that. And I found it a little harder than I thought it was going to be. I thought it was so simple. Wait, it's a little,
you know. That's the thing, isn't it, about the Beatles music? And I think that's one of the reasons it endures so strongly, is that it's simple. It seems simple, and yet it's so incredibly complicated. Very few of their songs, as opposed to Dylan's songs. Dylan's songs, he plays them in a complicated way, but they're basically, you know, three-chord songs. But Beatles songs are never three-chord songs.
No, there are a lot of musical ideas in those Beatles songs, and the ideas that Dylan employs are ideas of a different kind. You know, they're lyrical ideas, they're thematic ideas. I think McCartney is often unduly slighted.
Even in your New York...
Understood.
Even in your New York Times book review, they slighted Paul McCartney. Everybody wants to take a jab at Paul McCartney.
I mean, but he's often criticized as being, you know, a lightweight or lacking. But John was more of a thinker. John had more ideas. But Paul's music is rich with thinking and rich with ideas, but they're musical ideas. You know, they're not lyrical ideas.
Yeah, I mean, Silly Love Songs is a perfect example because that's a fantastic record. If you put on your headphones and listen to Silly Love Songs, that's an amazing, like, so many things happen in that song musically.
Yeah,
and that you kind of wish that the lyric would rise to the level of musicianship on that song.
Right. I mean, it starts with this very strange Pink Floyd-y kind of rhythmic thing. Like, where did that come from? And you don't know where it's going to go. It could fit on an avant-garde record. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I do.
And then it goes into that disco-y bass line. And then he has a simple chordal pattern that he overlays three melodies on top of. And they all come together in a Broadway show tune kind of way in the end where they're all sung simultaneously.
It's like a symphony
again,
with movements.
The ideas are musical ideas. that's the miracle of, you know, Lennon and McCartney, that they came together and the two different kinds of geniuses came together so beautifully. I try to fight the resistance in the book, my impulse to see the whole world through the lens of the Beatles because of my age, mm-hmm. and I didn't want it to be a book that...
Just a baby boomer appreciation.
Yeah, I really didn't want, and I'm really gratified that a lot of the reviews say it's not like a cranky old guy, it's not a baby, it's not baby boomer centric, that it's, you know, it's not even sort of a white male view of pop music history. It's a, you know, a more expansive, open-eyed look.
Yeah.
But then I looked at the index. I was looking up something in the index, and there are actually more entries for the Beatles than I think for anything else.
I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. Tonight we're chatting with music historian and critic David Heydu. His new book is called Love for Sale, Pop Music in America. When you and I were kids, there was oldies, and oldies was a word that was given to songs mostly from about 5 or 6 years earlier that reminded young adults of their teenage years, you know, songs like Earth Angel and Palisades Park and Sea Cruise. And now, oldies, they're no longer the 50s so much, but they're still the 60s and 70s. They're at least 40 years old. Whereas, you know, when we were kids, oldies were not 40 years old. And you actually come up with an interesting theory about that, having to do with Gene Autry.
Yeah, Gene Autry was a seminal figure in the history of 20th century music and of all of popular music, and his significance is largely forgotten. When people talk about the shift in the character of popular music from the urban, horn-based, jazz-oriented music of the pre-rock era, you know, the music that we think of as the Tin Pan, as of the Great American Songbook, or the standards, many of which came out of Broadway, or show tunes. They think of pianos, full bands, sometimes big bands. The music is thought of as being urban, sophisticated. A lot of harmony is chromatic. All those things that we think of are good ways to describe the music of the first half of the 20th century. Then something happened, and the music became more simpler, more vernacular, more conversational. The instrumentation was more... we now found string instruments, and the music was more rural, less urban, and we come to think of that music as more authentic. The reasons for the shift, when people try to come to terms with the reasons of the shift, sometimes they talk about Elvis Presley. He played an acoustic guitar. Sometimes talk about Dylan and the folk boom, which I've written about extensively and studied pretty extensively for my second book, as well as a lot of other things I've written. Bob Dylan, and before him, Woody Guthrie and Pete Seeger. But what the larger influence was the singing cowboys of the 1940s and early 1950s. People, specifically Gene Autry and then later Roy Rogers, who played simple, conversational, vernacular music about the natural world on guitars in a way that spoke specifically to young people and was intended to speak to young people at the expense of their parents without concerning themselves for the appeal to older people. And because this music and the films were geared to young people, older people looked down on them. They thought that they were juvenile, and that was all the more reason for young people to embrace these films in the same way that young people always embrace things that help give them a sense of their generational identity, a sense of generational pride. So young people, by millions and millions and millions, went to dozens and dozens, actually more than hundreds, of singing cowboy movies, both Gene Autry and Roy Rogers, and developed a taste a deep and a passion for a style of music made a particular way. And that really was the shift in the aesthetic of popular music. The BC AD point was not Woody Guthrie, who after all in his time, reached relatively few people. He was on a radio station in LA for a little while, and he did tours of labor camps and union halls for a while, and then he was taken up by the folk boom as a revered elder. But it's not really as if people knew many of his songs other than "This Land Is Your Land" or even that familiar with what he sounded like. I mean, I challenge most of the people who I know who talk about how great Woody Guthrie is, and I think he's great. I love him. To name three Woody Guthrie songs, or maybe two, one more than "This Land Is Your Land." And what opened my eyes to this, wasn't just an abstract theory of mine. I did an interview. I was assigned to interview the country supergroup, the Highwaymen. Remember them?
Chris Christopherson,
Johnny Cash, Willie Nelson, and Waylon Jennings. And I was writing for the Hollywood Reporter at the time. I'm a young music writer, and I was granted 15 or 20 minutes with them backstage at the Nassau Coliseum in Long Island. I went backstage with my giant Radio Shack tape recorder and a handful of softball questions, and I started out by asking each of them who was the musician most influential, most important to you. And I asked Johnny Cash, and I was expecting him to talk about maybe Jimmy Rogers or the Carter family, June Carter Cash. And he said, "Gene Autry." And I thought he was pulling my leg. I thought he was sort of making fun of the kid Yankee music writer. And then Willie Nelson chimed in. I thought he would talk about Django Reinhardt, because we know about his affection for John. And, he went on at greater length about Gene Autry. And Chris Christopherson was not there. Waylon Jennings had a beer can in his hand, and he slammed it down on the table, and he said, "Listen." He said, "Listen." He brought up the Woody Guthrie comparison. This is not something I came up with myself. He said, "Listen, how many people, he said something that Woody Guthrie was great. I have the exact quote in my book. But millions of kids went to see Gene Autry, and then they all burst into singing "Tumble and Tumbleweeds" together. This recording is like the three of them on my cassette recorder, singing "Tumble and Tumbleweeds."
Great.
Yeah, but again, critics are reluctant to take big pop phenomena seriously, and yet it often has a deep influence in the culture, and that's what happened with Gene Autry. And if you listen to those records, he was also damn good. And so was Roy Rogers, and a great guitar player, swinging guitar player.
Yeah, Roy Rogers had maybe a purer, prettier voice than Gene Autry.
Yeah. No question. I think part of Gene Autry's appeal is that he sounded like a non-singer. He sang in a way that maybe anybody could we all could relate to. This is not really my era. I have a brother who's 9 years older than me, and so the singing cowboys were like his thing. By the time I came along, it seemed like a really cornball phenomenon of the past. So it was hard for me to really warm up to the notion that this phenomenon was as significant as it was. But now I see there's really no question about it. My brother was a great influence on me, mainly because by sort of challenging everything that I believed as a kid. And
he must have had a record collection that you listened to.
He Yeah, he had Dylan, and in fact he had Richard Farina records and influenced my, who exposed me to Richard Farina, who I wrote about for my second book, and we no longer talk, my brother and I, because he and I have gone different ways politically, and I'm not going to take up our time with the details of this, but he was an important influence on me musically at one time. So I'll give him that.
It's interesting how people get kind of locked in to one kind of music, the kind of music that they like. It's their music, and they don't, they can't hear other kinds of music the way a lot of people our age, when they hear rap music or hip hop or whatever you want to call it. I remember when I think it was Rubber Soul, the American Rubber Soul came out, and I wanted to play I've Just Seen a Face for my dad, because I said, you're going to really like this. I mean, it's really good. And he goes, it all sounds exactly the same. And, you know, that song doesn't sound the same as any other song of theirs. But that's that thing that we get where we're not familiar with the music, and therefore it's... And we don't go back. We don't know the music from before, like you were just saying. And we don't listen to the music after. Just those music.
I know, that it's strange when we really don't understand something and we're blind to it and it all sounds the same. I have a little reference in my book to playing, I had Frank Sinatra record on. I played with a colleague of mine who's like an Americana fetishist. He loves, you know, American roots music. And I was playing, I think it was Songs for Swinging Lovers. It might have been Only the Lonely, but one of the great Sinatra records from the mid-60s. And he said to me exactly the same thing that your father said to me. He said, how can you tell the difference between these songs? They all sound the same. I said, what? It's like, one is Cole Porter, one is Harold.
They're Arnold. Not at all the same. What's the matter?
Rogers and Hart, what? No, but to him, now, but then when I hear...
Can you tell the difference between Flo Rida
two
and
Gilman
Kate
Rose songs? Two John Lee Hooker songs, you know?
Right. In both directions, like current music.
Bobby Blue, right. Yeah. But there's actually been some cognitive science on this subject. There's some social science on it, too. And there's some work that shows that our coming of age as individuals, both socially and biologically, occurs in early adolescence at the age of 13, around 13, 14, a little younger for females and a little older for males, like 13, 13 and a half for girls, 13 and a half, 14, 14 and a half for boys. And we start to develop a sense of ourselves and someone, you know, different from our parents, and we find to situate ourselves in relation to our peer group around this time. And a lot of this is connected to the emergence of our personal tastes, which are reinforced by the people we associate with, and to the degree that our music reached full bloom and tend to harden at that point because they're connected to our coming of age, both physiologically and socially. And something happens they take form and are resistant to change. So we tend to always love best the music we loved when we were around 14. And we never quite like anything else quite that much again. Now, it's not entirely the case for me, because what I've done is I'm always trying to discover new spheres of music, new kinds of music. And I'm interested in music that maybe it's just selfishness or avarice, but I'm really attracted to music I don't get or I don't understand. I love the challenge of trying to figure out a new thing. So it hasn't quite happened to me, but I will say, that said, that I still have a kind of a special fondness for the music from when I was 14, and most people do.
The book is called Love for Sale, Pop Music in America, and the author, the brilliant David Haydu, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
that's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes, and you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, David Heydu. His latest book is called Love for Sale, Pop Music in America. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening. See you next time.